International House of Horrors.
Valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast, your sanctuary of spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I'm one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I'm kind of sad because this is the first time since forever that we're just the two of us. Like the last 2 weeks we had guests on and now it's back to the two of us. But yeah, I'm Josh.
Yes. Yes. It's, and you know, just once again, thank you to Micah and thank you to Will for coming on. Had a great time.
Yeah,
on
it was
both
fun.
Of those episodes. It was a ton of fun, but it is just back to the two of us. We are down, I think we have, what, 7 episodes left? You've been keeping count for us.
Yeah, well, our provider has been keeping count for us, so I'm going to look it up really
quick.
Oh,
that's true. Okay, well, yeah, no worries right now. We can figure that stuff out later. It's just I got to start thinking, really thinking about the what we want to do for the final episode. Like, what's going to be the big finale. But yeah. For today, we are going to continue to work through the 101 horror movies to see before you die. And this was, and I don't think we've ever said whose list this is. Do you have the author's name in front of you? I've only got the list in front of me. I know you've checked out the book a couple of times.
I took it multiple times from the library, but always had to return it. So let me see, because I know the original, the 1001 movies you have to see. That's by Steven Schneider, I think is his name. And like he made the big book, but I'm not fully sure who made the smaller book. Because it's interesting. I never even thought. It's also by Steven Schneider, I think. He's the main guy behind it.
Okay, but I thought it was a woman writing this one. For some reason, let me try and find with you. This is all shit we should do when we're not in front of the microphones.
But it's so much more real if we do it right when we're recording. But so what I think is
that
like
is
it's
true.
Those are so Steven Schneider is like the editor. He put them together. But as far as I know, these are always like multiple people working on it. Like he just has a bunch of writers.
Oh, he's got a bunch of different people.
Yeah, and so each review is by a different person, and he just put them together.
That's a smart way to write a book. You don't even have to write it.
Yeah, you just have get to everybody, pick the movies.
You just got to pick the movies and get everybody else to write it for you. That's kind of awesome, though. Okay, so that's the book we're working off anyway, and I'm looking at it. It looks like it's available on a couple different places. Used, you know, eBay, Abe Books. I'm looking right now. It's a couple different places. If anyone was really interested, you can get it for $10. It's not bad. Or be like Josh, just go to the library and find it, and you can check it out there.
Yeah,
libraries are awesome like that.
Yeah, although right now it's kind of hard getting to the library because everything is closed.
Yeah, well, I thought they said they were easing some restrictions for you guys.
Yeah, they are now starting like small businesses under 800 square meters are allowed to open again.
Oh, nice.
And and so it's slowly getting back, but now you have to wear a mask to every store, and they still have restrictions like how many people can go in. I'm not sure if our library has opened again or not, so I haven't checked it out yet. But
Does your library do ebook checkouts?
Yes, they also do those. They have like a few.
Yeah, that's nice. Ours does the same thing where you can get audiobooks, you can get ebooks, all kinds of good shit. But anyway, let's get on with this and do what we are here to do. So today we've got numbers 61 through 70.
Yeah,
61 to 70. And the first up, I'm going to let you drive the bus, so you can get us started, get us going, and let's do it, man. Let's do these movies.
Yeah, and the first one is one that's always controversial when I'm talking about it, because I'm still saying that I'm not fully a fan of it because I haven't watched the right version yet. Because the first movie on this list is from 1978 by George Romero. It's the second movie by George Romero on the list. It's Dawn of the Dead.
And right on.
Yeah, this is one where we have to have the whole discussion, which cut is the best. There are so many, and the only one I've seen so far is a three-hour cut in German dub where they just edited everything in that they had.
And that one was a mix of, I can't remember how many different versions it was a mix of. The two big versions that you get are the Romero version and then the Argento version.
Yeah, for the European market. Yeah.
Right. So you get those two different, because Fulci was like, fuck it, I'm just going to make my own thing and make Zombie 2. Yeah. Which he was riding on this coming out around the same time. I borrowed it from a friend and I haven't returned it yet. I've had it forever. You actually met him. We played games together. Tony.
Oh,
Tony,
yeah.
He lent me his big 3-hour version. I still have not made the time. I think partially just because I forget it's in the DVD case. I haven't seen that big 3-hour one yet. I've only ever seen, I have seen the Italian one or the European one, but maybe not. I'm not 100% sure, but I know I've seen the original many, many times. The U.S., I shouldn't say the original, but the... Well, you know what? That probably is the fucking original because it was Romero's cut of the movie.
Yeah.
And Dawn of the Dead is really interesting for me in that there's a lot of people who argue this is the best of the Dead movies. That this is, you know, better than Night of the Living Dead. He had already gotten his feet wet. He's now a little bit bigger budget. Still not a huge budget. I want to say this was made for... a relatively small amount of money. I don't have the... See if I can pull the IMDb up, even though you never
you
really
go
know
on. I look it up.
Yeah, so they take a lot of things happen in this of the Dead movie, which for a lot of people I think is why they consider it the better zombie movie, is we actually get a lot more zombies. You get to actually see the zombies being zombies. The... message, Romero was always big on trying to, you know, put that message into there. This one about capitalism, I think, is so much clearer than the messages we got in the first movie, because it's all just right there in front of your face. And it's such an iconic setting. Them in that mall. I mean, it's
a great
idea.
It's
so badass. Yeah. It really is a good idea. Not only do you get the... Well, we had a little bit of the human-on-human stuff, the panic stuff between Harry and Ben in the first one. Those two were kind of at odds throughout the entire thing. But you get some great players in this one, too. You've got Ken Forhey. This is the first time I remember seeing him, and he's kind of become a genre icon over the years. And then Tom Savini in there as well, which is always fun. Anytime you get to see Tom is good.
Tom Savini is always fun, yeah.
He is. And I think I had mentioned, maybe I didn't, but this one is in color. This is the first time we got Of the Dead in color, which is a big thing because you're actually seeing the blood and you're seeing the zombies. It's a great... I mean, it fucking 100% deserves to be on this list.
Dawn
of the Dead is amazing. It was... And as much as I love Day of the Dead, I feel like that's where it started to take a turn. And you started getting more of the comedy elements in there. And it wasn't quite as serious because it was what? Day, night, day, dawn, day, land? I think land was next.
I think after day was land. Yeah, there was Land of the Dead. And then
you get all the diary, survival of the living dead. He did a few more after that progressively got more silly as you go along. But this one is, I'm interested in seeing that version that you saw. But didn't Goblin do the music for that one?
No, Goblin did the music for the
US?
The European cut, the Argento
that's what I mean.
Version. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Goblin did for Argento because Goblin did everything for Argento.
Yeah,
no matter
we're together always, yeah. And but this 3-hour cut that I got is like it's made by a German guy, the one that I have. Like he said it's really funny because there's a making of it, of how he did it, and it's literally one guy sitting there with like an editing machine and two computers sitting there and cutting the two versions together. So it's really funny.
I do need to watch it. I do need to watch it.
Yeah, you should. But it's, I'm just saying, like, it was still good. It still had some great elements to it. But it was just so long and boring. And then I'm not a fan of German dubs. Everyone knows that. And this was all dubbed in German.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is tough.
It wasn't fun.
And, you know, I was, not to change the subject, I'm sorry, but Shayna has been rewatching all of the Golden Girls, which I fucking love. It was amazing TV show. But for some reason, Hulu for us, because sometimes she'll turn on the captions if she's just kind of wandering around, or if the, you know, baby's out playing around or something. And sometimes the caption will be, or if the baby's sleeping and we need to, you know, we don't want the TV too loud. But watching the captions with the Golden Girls, every once in a while, I'll sit down and look at it. Some of the dialogue is completely different than what they say. And so you wonder, you know, how much is truly lost when somebody dubs something or translates something? How much do you really lose? It's tough.
Yeah,
we just need to learn every language there is from filmmaking countries, and then we'll be all right. Be able to watch everything. Yeah,
that would be, that would probably be the best way to go. Yeah, just learn everything and then you're right. Good to go and you can actually enjoy the movies.
Yeah, I think if I could do any of them, it would probably be Japanese. I think I would want to speak fluent Japanese to watch those movies in their original language. And not only so much for just the horror movies, just all the movies in general. The old samurai flicks.
Yeah, either those, maybe Korean, because they make some of the greatest movies. Or like what I even tried learning for like a week and then I gave up is Swedish, because there's so many great Swedish movies that I watched and I tried it, but
yeah,
didn't go well.
So for now, we'll just have to go with the dubs and accept what we get. It is what you get. But I do feel with some of the bigger movies, I feel like maybe they have, especially bringing a movie over to an English-speaking market, they might put a little more effort into it. I hate to say that, but I think they have people who, you know, probably get paid a little bit more to do these dubs because you're trying to sell it to a much bigger audience. I don't know, because I don't know these original languages, so I don't know what we're getting or what we're losing. But I think of something like, you know, you're talking Korean, I Saw the Devil. I feel like when I watched the subtitles for that, the translation was really good. Yeah. I don't feel like, other times you can see it. You can see where the translation's bad, just as like, okay, that doesn't make a lot of sense, or I don't think this is what they've said. Famously, if you've ever seen those videos of the Marvel movies translated to Chinese, have you ever watched that stuff on YouTube?
I think I've seen one, but I don't even remember what was, but there was something weird about him, right? What's going on there?
There's funny as shit. Sometimes, I mean, these huge heroic moments, they'll change to where it makes barely any sense. And you're like, wait, what the fuck? Like that's not even what happened here. But anyway, back to Dawn of the Dead. This is also, I would say the last thing I'll bring up about Dawn of the Dead is one, it's an absolute watch. Definitely watch it. But two, we get a long period of time with this one, which we didn't see. You know, Night of the Living Dead, we just had the one night, and that was it. We were with this group of people throughout the night at the farmhouse.
And the night started. We got to say that as well. Like it was right when it started.
Yeah, as everything kicked off, this stuff has been going on. The SWAT team or the military evacuates a bunch of people. They end up at the mall, but they're at the mall for a while.
Yeah.
People almost start living in the mall, which I think is cool too. You know, we're not just, oh, this is one event, which you get a lot of times with zombie out, any kind of outbreak movie, really. We usually follow the epicenter of it, and then it grows really fast, and we kind of experience the action through all of it. Whereas with Dawn, I thought he did a good job with expanding that and now, you know, fleshing it out. What would this look like over the course of a month or even longer?
Yeah,
so it's good.
I feel like even though Night of the Living Dead started the zombie, the flesh-eating zombie, Dawn of the Dead is what actually made the flesh-eating zombie. Like that was the reason why there is the zombie craze that's still going on. It's slowing down a bit again, luckily. But like I think that's Dawn of the Dead to thank for, because Night of the Living Dead, it is a great movie, and still I think I prefer it over Dawn. I do prefer it over the Dawn of the Dead I watched, but it's something different. It's not as mainstream as Dawn of the Dead is. Like Dawn of the Dead, you can throw on in every cinema and everyone will watch it. With Night of the Living Dead, there will be people who will still look away because it's black and white. And
that's, I would say that's fair. this one is, it's definitely, like I said, there's, I know individuals who will argue this is the best of the dead movies. I'm with you and say Night of the Living Dead is hands down the best. But to your point, that is a good point that this did kind of define the zombies, because in Night of the Living Dead, we didn't really spend a lot of time with the zombies. In this one, you get those, you know, the shots and the blood and the rot, how they look. You can, you know, now see it in color, how the flesh is a different color, the deterioration is taking place. So it's a great movie.
Yeah,
great
although movie. The color of the faces, I think, was actually like a mistake of the film itself, because I think they had some problem with the film, and that's why the people, the zombies look so blue. They looked different in the when they shot it, and the film kind of had a problem, and that's why they are in this kind of, like, they have a weird color in this movie.
Yeah, they are very blue. They look how the Munsters looked in that original pilot episode of the Munsters. And I do like the, you know, we get a motorcycle gang in this one. Yeah. You know, you get a very cool human versus human element. But yeah.
Yeah.
Dawn of the Dead, check it out for sure if you've never seen it from 78. Sure.
And by the way, the production budget was $1.5 million.
So not big at all.
Yeah.
Especially to shoot in a mall. That's, yeah. You know, I'm sure that took some effort. They were probably just shooting at night, having to go in.
Yeah, I think that's what I heard. And during the day, it was actually open. Like, people would go shopping, and then during the night, they would go crazy.
that would be a tough production, just being up all night working, having to switch your whole schedule around. But yeah, great movie. Awesome movie.
Let's go on. The next one is one that I kind of pushed off watching and haven't watched again, but I saw it once, and I remember it's being long, and like it's not even long, but it felt long and kind of boring. It's Nosferatu. It's the German, so it's Nosferatu Phantom der Nacht. The Nosferatu remake by Werner Herzog and Klaus Kinski in the role of Nosferatu. And it's another Nosferatu. It's basically the same movie. I think almost a shot-for-shot remake, but kind of not as good.
And this one is really strange. So I rewatched this, and first I didn't know that Kinski was, like, everyone said he was a fucking crazy person in life. Like, he was very tyrannical, and but he played this role so well. The thing with this movie, and you and I talked about it a little bit already, we were kind of going back and forth, just chatting.
Yeah,
I watched it. People are like praising this thing. I looked at some critical reviews of it, and everyone's talking how it's, you know, amazing, amazing, amazing. And I enjoy it, but I think I had said to you before, and I stand by my statement, I would never choose this over the original. I never once, if you were to say, hey, let's watch Nosferatu, which one do you want to watch? I would never choose Nosferatu the Vampire. It's cool. They had a bigger budget. He was genuinely creepy, but is he creepier than Shrek was? No, I don't think so, because Shrek still haunts my nightmares.
Yeah.
That man really was a fucking vampire. You convinced me otherwise. Convince me otherwise that he was not a vampire. But
he totally was, yeah.
This is a very slow burn vampire horror movie. Slow as shit.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying is a bad thing. I think being slow like that, it can be very effective. We get into, I think, the mentality and the psychology of Nosferatu a little more than we get in the original, but I don't think it works any better than what they did with the original movie. So I think this is fine, but if the call was up to me, I would not have put this on this list. I would have replaced it with something else. I don't know what from 1979 I would have replaced it with, but it wouldn't have been Nosferatu the Vampire. It's a good movie. I'm not trying to take away from that. I just don't see why you put it on this list when you have the original on this list. I don't understand.
Yeah, I think we talked about it. So I looked in the 1001 movies book, because I have that here, and there they said they have it in that book as well. So it's not just one of the horror movies you have to see, but they say it's one of the 1001 movies you have to see before you die. And I think what they said is the reason they put it on there is because it put the mysterious back into horror movies at a time when it's mostly shock and gore and special effects, and this went back to the mysterious ways, and like I don't know. I don't think it had a big impact on movie history at the time. Like, it's not like it's a movie that changed how people made movies or changed the horror genre.
I agree with you, man. excuse me. I agree with you. I just don't. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's, you know, when it comes to horror movies, you know, I love my slasher flicks and my gore movies, but I like them all. I like a good ghost story at the same time. It's just not there for me. Yeah. I don't know. And I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone who really loves this movie, but it's a fine movie. It just doesn't, for me, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's just not there.
If you're a fan of the movie and you want to tell us why it belongs on the list, please send us a message, because we genuinely, I'd like to know, and I want to rewatch it, but I couldn't get myself to it because I watched it like 10 years ago, and back at the time it felt boring and long. It's probably not as boring as it felt back then, because back then I was like, I just started getting into movies and, you know, slow is always boring, but yeah, I still, to this day, I can't really get myself to watch it again.
Yeah. Maybe when you do, you can come back. If you can squeeze it in sometime this week, come back and let us know. But I'm with you there. There's never a part of me that's drawn to rewatch this movie. Not like the next one.
Yeah.
The next one I rewatch quite a bit. Go ahead.
Let's go to the next one. It's also from 1979, directed by Don Coscarelli, I think is his name. And it's Phantasm, or as the German title, Das Böse, which just means the evil.
The evil.
Yeah.
You guys keep taking these titles, and sometimes you get a hit, but other times I think Phantasm is just a cool word.
Yeah.
Like it's a super cool title, and Phantasm as a kid scared the shit out of me. This is one of those few movies, and it wasn't anything about like the deaths and stuff like that. What scared me more than anything was Angus Scrimm, the tall man. He's terrifying. Yeah. Yeah. And him, you know, that scene, probably the first time that, what was the little kid's name?
Micah?
Was it Mike? Yeah, I think you're right.
I'm going to look it up.
I thought Mike was the older brother, but I could be wrong.
Oh no, the actor of the boy is A. Michael Baldwin. Yeah, but he's Mike.
Okay.
His brother is Bill Thornberry, played
Reggie is the friend.
And Reggie is
a great guitar player too. I love that scene. You remember when the guy comes up to deliver his milk or some shit and they sit down and play guitars together?
Yeah.
There, I really like that he's a good guitar player on top of it. But the first time that Michael is in they're in a graveyard. Is he in like a mausoleum of some sort?
I think it's in a mausoleum, yeah.
Yeah, he's in a mausoleum. And the first time you see that orb, the first orb, get that guy in the face, you know, the spikes come out and then you just get that fountain, that straight fountain of blood coming out.
Yeah.
And then you have Angus, you have the tall man walking like really fast after Michael, chasing him down to get this kid. And it's I don't know, I just love this movie. Because it's almost like a horror adventure movie. Because you have these, you know, these three kind of friends together trying to solve this mystery and get people to believe them. Well, one kid and his brother and then their friend Reggie. And the entire time and then you come to find out that Angus Scrimm has this little army of minions. The tall man has all this little army of minions. That
help like,
him out
like the guys from Star Wars, the Jawas.
The Jawas, yeah, they do. They kind of act and look like Jawas. And Angus Scrimm, the other part that scared me as a kid, where he transformed into that woman, and then he turns back into the tall man after they have sex in the graveyard or something like that, was always really creepy. And this spawned some cool sequels at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, this turned into a franchise where we have five movies total, And the fifth one being a lot more recent, maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah, the fifth one was when we started the Film House podcast back in the day. So it was like 2017, I think.
Yeah. And that was right before Angus Scrim had passed away. So that was one of the last things that he was able to do.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And Angus Scrim passed away much more recently, right? It's funny because in preparation for I went to another Splatterday Night Fever, so a horror night. Oh no, he passed away in January of 2016.
Okay. Yeah, so it was right before the movie came out.
Yeah. So back then when it all started, I was going with Michael, who, for anyone who has listened to the Film House podcast, he doesn't like horror. But I talked him into going to a Splatterday Night Fever where they showed like four or five horror movies. And they showed the newest Phantasm movie. So Phantasm 5, I think it's Phantasm Ravager.
Ravager. Yeah.
And we actually, in preparation, Michael didn't go fully through with it, but I watched all four Phantasm movies like a few days before the Splatterday Night Fever. All in a row, all in German dub and cut versions because that movie was still banned at the time over here. So all I had was like, I have this cool box that's like the four movies and Angus Scrim is on the back, like the tall man is on the backs if you put them together. And
cool.
The box looks really cool. But yeah, they're all in German dub, they're all banned and there's not an option to watch them in the original version. But it's... with these movies, I think it kind of works because even though, especially the first one, is really good, it's also kind of campy, right? Like it's
it's absolutely
it really works and so with these, it's okay to watch them cut and in a German dub. It still works and so I watched the whole story and it's crazy that they made like. It's one continuous story from the first movie. Then I think the sequel was even like a few years later, right? Like the first one was in 79. Phantasm 2 was in 88. Phantasm 3 in 94. And Phantasm 4 in 98. And then 2016 we got Phantasm 5.
5.
And they kept the cast other than I think for the second movie they had to switch out Mike, I think. It's all very bizarre, but it's a fun story. And yeah, especially the first one, it's kind of what I heard, because if you watch it, it doesn't fully make sense. But I think you can watch this as like a dream, because spoiler alert, I guess it, in the end, it turns out it's all a dream. Or is it? But it's,
yeah, I don't know if I don't know. I don't think they knew the movie was going to see the success that it did.
Yeah, I think this was one that similar to Eraserhead was just like shut over a long time with just like Don Coscarelli just wanted to make this movie. And so he put all his money into this movie and shot it with his friends. I mean, Mike and Reggie both are named after their actors. It's
right.
So, yeah, and I think Angus Scrim was the... And most of them also didn't do much else. Like, Reggie Bannister is now going into, like, these low-budget horror movies and is doing smaller roles. But they're all known for the Phantasm series. And yeah. Those movies...
And it's a great series, though. Yeah. It is. It's a great series, and it's a ton of fun. And I'm glad it's on this list. I think it definitely deserves to be.
And it often gets overlooked, so it really fits in there. It's one that people should see. Like, that's what I use these lists for, to find movies that I haven't watched yet or haven't heard of.
Yeah.
And, like, this would be one.
I've seen many times. I think I don't remember a ton about 3 or 4. I don't watch those quite as much, so maybe I'll go back and watch those sometime soon. Because I know I've got them all on VHS, and I've got them all digitally. So they're all there for the watching. Because when Ravager came out, they had a special deal on all 5 movies for $20 or something like that on iTunes. So I snagged them all when I could. Because they're wonderful. They're fun movies. Like you said, they're campy. They're silly. Yeah. The special effects are super cool. The tall man is a great villain. There's just so much to enjoy with these movies. There's a ton of fun to be had.
And they're different. Like, this is... There's not many... You can't say Phantasm is like any other movie, really.
No, that's true. It's definitely its own thing. Stands on its own feet.
Yeah, so let's go on. The next movie is from 1979. I think it's not the first movie by David Cronenberg, but one of his earliest. It's The Brood. Yeah.
The Brood. The Brood.
Yeah, you go on.
So I rewatched this. I had seen The Brood many years ago, and it had been quite some time. Because usually when it comes to Cronenberg, I tend to go The Fly, Scanners, Videodrome, if I'm just in the mood for Cronenberg. Or what's the one in the hotel or the apartment? Rabid? Is Rabid the... Which one had the...
I haven't seen that one yet.
I thought there was one where it was like a sexually transmitted disease. I thought it was called Rabid, yeah, but I could just be making that up. I have no idea. Let me see. Oh yeah, it's from 77, Rabid, and I think that was the one where they're all in a. Again, I'm just sitting here, not really doing what I'm supposed to be doing, looking for other things. But now I'm curious. I want to make sure that. And it looks like you don't have Tubi. Damn it.
Yeah.
Rabid's the one. The woman develops a taste for human blood after experimental plastic surgery. And then her victims turn bloodthirsty. But I think there was a sex element to that. It could be. It's Cronenberg. There's always a weird sex body horror. But The Brood from 1979. So after rewatching this, I forgot. Or maybe I just appreciate it differently now how fucking good this movie is. It's really is something special. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but what makes it so special is when you get to that ending. Because it really is like, what the fuck, man? Like, this is really happening. You're showing me all this shit, aren't you, David Cronenberg? But the story itself, you have a man whose wife is at a retreat for an extreme experimental psychological therapy. There's something wrong with this woman. We don't 100% know what it is. I don't remember if they say they might. She had some kind of a breakdown or something like that. But she's at this place where this doctor does extreme therapy, but everybody who's gone through his therapy says it's great. It's super effective. It's the way he does it. You know, he'll sit down and pretend to be someone who had hurt these people in their lives. He sits down with one man and he's pretending to be his father. He gets really deep into the psyche to help these people out. On the flip side of that, this woman has a daughter. Her husband is in, you know, the outside world. He's got to bring the daughter to see her every once in a while, but the kid keeps coming back with like marks on her. And he's like, I'm not bringing this kid here anymore because clearly my wife, they're still married at the time, is abusing her. They don't let him see his wife. They only let the little girl go spend time with her mother. And then we start seeing these little nightmare children of sorts showing up and beating people with meat mallets, killing all these different individuals. And I don't want to spoil the ending for this because I think it's really good and it's really effective. But this movie as a whole, if you've never seen it, there's some other really good ones on this list that I would recommend highly. But this one I would say if you've never seen it, all the other ones I feel like people have seen for the most part. But this one, check it out if you've never seen The Brood. It's really good. Really cool.
It really is. I watched it 2 years ago, and I got to say, now that you talked about it, I thought I knew what it was about, but then now that you talked about it, I remembered again what it really was about. Yeah. And those children are creepy as fuck the whole way through.
They remind me of that little... Well, no, I'm not even going to say that because that's a big spoiler for another movie. But yeah, another movie we've talked about on this list. But yeah, they are. Like, I mean, really... But that's Cronenberg. He's known not so much in his later career, but his whole early career was do weird shit to the human body. What can you do to the human body and make it terrifying? And one thing you can do is make children look like little fucking nightmare zombie people. Not even zombie, like... kind of troll goblin children.
Yeah.
You know, these really fucking distorted, weird features, but dressed up as children, which I think makes it even creepier. The Brood is fantastic.
The Brood is really good. Yeah, everyone check it out. And I don't have anything to add, but let's go on to the next one. I think the next one is from 1980, even though the list online says it's from 2003, and it's like, it's probably a documentary about the movie. Oh, yeah.
Because that title is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the movie I want to talk about is Cannibal Holocaust, or as the Germans call it, nackt und zerfleischt, which means naked and mauled.
That might be a better title than Cannibal Holocaust. That's one of the times you guys got it right. Yeah. Or at least, I don't know, though. Just saying Cannibal Holocaust makes you think of some really bad shit happening.
Yeah.
Because naked and mauled could be, you know, I'm out in the woods and got killed by a bear. Cannibal Holocaust really paints the picture of what you're getting into. I think it's very clear. Cannibal Holocaust is that movie that everyone, if they decide, you know what, I'm a horror fan, I'm going to start venturing into horror. Cannibal Holocaust is for a lot of people, at least maybe not so much anymore because of the internet. You can find everything almost anywhere. But back in the day, it was kind of that like sought after thing that you watched, you know, when you knew your parents weren't going to come in, like they can't find me watching this thing, or you had a friend who knew who had a copy of it or something like that. I didn't physically own a copy until I was an adult. It took me a long time to find a copy. When did you see this for the first time?
It was a few years ago. It was around the time when I really got into the crazier movies. Like, it was around the time I also watched a Serbian film and 120 Days of Solo. Salo, the 120 Days of Sodom. Yeah. And I actually watched this with a group of friends. I got people together and made them watch this movie with me. And I was much younger, and it's crazy. Like,
still so shocking.
Yeah,
it really is still so shocking. And what was was it the producer and the director got called into court?
At least the director, and I think the producer as well. Yeah, because they had to, I think they had to, I think at the time they actually, said that the actors should disappear for a while so they could make it seem real. And then they were made to prove that the people are alive. Because you got to say, like, some of the stuff looks really, really realistic.
Right.
Like, that one of the most famous scenes is probably the one of the native lady sitting on a, being like flocked. It looks so fucking realistic. And in the end, it's just her sitting on a bicycle seat and having a flock in her mouth.
Right.
But it looks so realistic that, like, you might think this is real. And, like, who knows what they're doing with these cannibals in the woods. They're probably real cannibals.
That's what makes this movie work so well. And this, it could be argued the first found footage movie.
Yeah,
I think you can make a good argument because you have a group who's going to look for another group who had gone into the jungle, and they end up finding a bunch of videos of stuff that had been recording. What always gets me about this movie, and a lot of people still talk about, is all of the animal deaths are real.
Yeah.
Which is, it's tough to watch. But I know, you know, it's hard because on one hand, I know in the jungle, that's probably how these people would be. You know, you kill the turtle, you eat it. And in the movie, they did eat the meat. They didn't just kill it for the sake of killing it. But you see all these real animal deaths. You get the turtle. There's a pig that dies.
Yeah.
A couple of monkeys, I think, get killed along the way. A lot of real deaths.
With the monkey, it's actually, they wanted to use a fake monkey brain. But like for the people there, the natives, monkey brain was a delicacy, so they asked if they could have a real monkey, and that's why they did it.
And if you're doing it in that context, it's hard though because you feel like you're doing it for entertainment value.
Yeah.
Even if they are going to eat the meat, there's still that element where you're like, oh, this was done just for entertainment. But if they ate it, they ate it.
Yeah.
Where this always got me is just the effects are so unbelievably good.
Yeah.
That you're just fully convinced this shit could have really been happening.
Yeah.
I remember seeing it the first time and being like, what the fuck am I watching? Like, this is not right. This is crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where you feel bad watching it, where you feel like, okay, no, I shouldn't be watching this. This is not good. Like with the Serbian film. Like this is one of those movies where you're just like, should I really be watching this? Should I actually be owning this? This just feels all wrong.
Yeah, everything about this makes me feel dirty.
Yeah.
But again, I've watched it a couple times since. You know, I've probably seen the movie a handful of five, six times. It's because it's still a good movie.
Yeah.
They did such a good job putting this together. And I think that was the intent of the director, was to make you feel that way, to make you feel really uncomfortable and to make you feel gross. And it just works. Cannibal Holocaust, if you've never seen it, warning, it is a very extreme horror movie in so many ways. It will get under your skin.
Yeah.
I promise you that. It will make you feel uncomfortable. For some people, I can see it making them feel physically ill. You know, the woman on the shore, that's always been one of the most intense things for me to watch, because you see these extreme acts of violence, but there's no, you know, not a lot of music or anything, not a lot of crazy moving shots, like a lot of static shots just showing this violence happen. And it's intense. And you get the people who we see on the video were also pieces of shit, you know, like attacking the women and raping them and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I, now that you added the raping the women, I got to rephrase my sentence, because I was going to say that's what I really like about this movie. Is what I really like about this movie is the story that they put there, because it's about this documentary crew that are like these nature documentarians that had already a few prizes, I think. They travel into the woods to find cannibals and make a documentary about them, about the fucked up shit that's going on there. But it's not great, and then they got lost, and so these other people that we are following are trying to find them, and they are finding footage and things along the way, and they are finding out that these guys were actually just like huge assholes, and basically just They staged everything, and the people weren't as bad until, like, I think in one scene they go to one of their places and burn it down to have a great scene, and like, so that's we get one more of those movies where if you just see the title and hear talked about it, you think like, okay, yeah, this is one of those, yeah, those are the bad guys, the cannibals are the bad guys, but this is actually about how the civilized normal people are actually the bad guys.
And they become almost primal over the course of this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once they get there and into this isolated area. Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point.
So this movie is even more than just like fucked up shit happening. Like, this has more of a message than a Serbian film, for example.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you have anything else to add? Because then we can go on.
No, I think we did that one justice.
Okay. The next one is a movie that I've actually just watched not too long ago, like a couple months ago, from 1980. Is it Francis Ford Coppola? Now I'm not
no,
fully
it's,
sure.
No, it's Brian De Palma.
Ah, Brian De Palma, yeah. It's Dressed to Kill with Michael Caine.
And I think, Angie Dickinson.
Yeah, I think last week when we were talking about doing this episode, I think you told me that you are kind of wondering why Dressed to Kill is on there, or like at least a bit surprised about it.
Yeah, because this one for me is so much more psychological, but I've thought about that, but I'm afraid if I say what I'm about to say, I'm ruining this movie. Because, okay, maybe I'll try my best to say it without saying it. There is another movie that I hold very high regard for. People listening, somebody might be able to figure this out, but people listening would know it's in my top like three movies of all time. It's very similar to this movie, the way it plays out, and I would call the other one a horror movie for sure.
Yeah.
I would say that's a horror movie. This is very similar when you look at the whole story and what ends up being at the end of this thing. It's very similar. So I don't know if you've pieced that together, what I might be talking about.
I know
about.
What you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. So I would say in that regard, then yes, because it's so similar, this would definitely be a horror movie. But there's so much psychological stuff going on in this as well.
Yeah, actually, the podcast Evolution of Horror that I've been talking about a few times, who are going like through one subdivision of the horror genre, and talking about movies each week. They, in their very first installment where they talked about slasher movies, they had Dress to Kill on the list of the slasher movies as one of the first slashers, actually. This came out before Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. And it is kind of a slasher. I think the body count is a bit lower than what we got. But this is the typical, slashing movie. Like, there's lots of stabbing and knife using in there.
The big difference with this one is that we've got Michael Caine as a lead in this. And so a lot of your early slashers, Halloween, Black Christmas, you didn't have such an established actor playing the lead role. And Michael Caine just absolutely does an amazing job in this. I mean, I'm a huge Michael Caine fan regardless. I keep recommending it to people. If you ever get a chance to read his book, I wouldn't even say read it, listen to the audiobook, because he reads it. He reads the audiobook and, adds a couple things in here and there, which is awesome. But Michael Caine is such an amazing presence on the screen, no matter what he's in.
Yeah.
The dude is just wonderful. One of my favorites, The Man Who Would Be King, with him and Connery, it's not a horror movie at all, but it's just so fucking good. Such a good movie.
I recently watched The Italian Job, the original, for the first time, which is also with him. And it's actually kind of weird because I think The Italian Job and this one are the only movies of his I've seen where he's young. Like, usually...
Yeah.
He's much more known now for his roles with Nolan and the more recent movies.
Oh yeah, the Nolan stuff is the big stuff.
Yeah.
That's the really big stuff.
And so for the beginning of both of these movies, watching it and seeing a young Michael Caine feels kinda weird, because it's like you know this voice, you know what he looks like, but he just looks so much younger.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and this one, the story, for anyone who's interested, you have a blonde woman, kind of we don't see this blonde woman. We just know it's a blonde woman, kills a patient of this psychiatrist, but someone witnesses this murder, and now we've got this blonde woman going after this witness to this terrible murder, and this mysterious person is killing a lot of people along the way. So like you said, it's a really good slasher, but at the same time, we're trying to figure it out along the way. It's not a slasher. It's more like Black Christmas. We never see Billy. It's not like Michael, where you see him the whole time. We never really get a good look at this killer up until the end, and you get this fucking really awesome ending to this movie. And this one that I saw recently too, it popped up on Prime, and the only reason I clicked on it, because it was Brian De Palma and Michael Caine. I was like, well, what is this? Those are two names I really like. I'm going to watch this movie, and was very happy that I did end up watching it, because it's a great, effective little horror movie. It hits all the right notes. And again, you get to this awesome big reveal at the end that's super cool as well.
Yeah, and Brian De Palma, he's one of those guys with a career that I'm always surprised to hear, okay, this is another Brian De Palma movie. Like, when not too long ago I watched Phantom of the Paradise, and like, usually with De Palma, you think of Dress to Kill, you think of Carrie, but he went all over the place, really.
yeah, he really did. I mean, he did a ton of shit.
And he did Mission Impossible, right? The first one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did the first Mission Impossible. He's done a ton of great things, and this one is no different. It's a great movie. Yeah. I don't know if it's still available on... Let me see if I can bring it up, because I would encourage people to check this one out.
Yeah, it's another one of those that isn't much talked about. Maybe because, there's a discussion if it's even a real horror movie. But also, I'm not just a horror fan. I'm listening for all kinds of horror movies, and this is not one talked about a lot.
Right. Yeah, but it's good. It's really good. And Michael Caine is just amazing in it.
Yeah.
So watch it.
Yeah. And so you just gave this great description of a movie about a killer that goes around, and we're kind of following along, wondering who he is. And then at the end, we get this big reveal about who it really is. And that fits perfectly for the next movie on our list, which for sure has to be on the list. It's Friday the 13th.
The original.
Yeah.
1980. Friday the 13th. It's one we have talked about many times. And this one is dedicated to Will. because last week after we stopped recording, he's like, you guys have done all these lists, but you haven't had any Friday the 13th yet. And this is, I don't know if this is on the list because it started the franchise. I would think so, because I feel like Friday the 13th that everybody remembers is Jason. Nobody really recalls, you know, the first Friday the 13th. I love the first Friday the 13th. I think it's a great movie. Watched it many times. It's such a cool poster, too. Whoever designed that poster did an amazing job.
Yeah, that poster is awesome.
It was Sean Cunningham has said many times, like, we were trying to capitalize on Halloween.
Yeah.
We were trying to make a little low-budget horror movie and capitalize on the success of that. We were stealing ideas from that, just trying to make a buck. You know, and we weren't trying to create the probably biggest horror icon of all time. We were just trying to make a couple dollars.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's why it's on the list, because it is also like Friday the 13th. Like, you talk about the whole franchise, but you always take the first one because Friday the 13th is just... Exactly, shows that about what the slasher genre became afterwards. It was mostly, let's make a quick buck, because slasher movies are easy. They have a simple formula. You just need to have an idea for a cool killer. And this is like the quintessential slasher movie. Halloween started it, but Friday the 13th is where it's nothing else. It's just there's someone going around killing teenagers at
trope
a camp.
After trope after trope. We now consider to be horror movie tropes. And the thing was, you know, they made the movie for $500,000 and it made like $40 million.
Yeah.
The return on investment was crazy. And that's why we got so many other Friday the 13th, one right after another. And it's one of the foundational horror movies. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. Without it, we wouldn't have horror movies the way we have them today.
Yeah.
And you had Tom Savini doing the effects in this thing, which I think without that, this movie might not be what it is today.
Yeah.
Because those effects looked so good at the time. And they said, I don't remember who the producer was. I only remember Cunningham as the director. But they went and found Savini after Dawn of the Dead. They were like, this guy's effects are just so good. We need to get him on this movie if we can. And that's why they pulled him in. Because they had seen Dawn of the Dead and said, oh, this is the guy. We got to get this guy to do it. And you have those, probably most iconically, is the arrow through the windpipe.
Kevin Bacon. Yeah.
That Kevin Bacon gets on there.
I mean, that's one of those. It doesn't make any sense if you think about it for a second. Especially if you... I think we can spoil this movie, right? Everyone knows Pamela Voorhees is the killer. So now imagine there's Kevin Bacon... going into his bedroom with his girlfriend, and they're having sex on this bed, on the bottom bunk. It's not like a bunk bed where they're on top. They're on the bottom bunk. They're having sex. And then all this time, this old lady is laying under the bed. And then she's reaching out her hands, holding his head. Okay, that's working. But how does she get this arrow through the bed, through the sheets?
Right.
Through him from the... Like, it's not like she can have... hold it up. It has to be a foldable arrow at least.
Something. Or she had the arrow already pre-staged halfway up through the mattress so that it was just barely enough to where he couldn't feel it, and then just jammed it the rest of the way through. She just took a good guess at exactly where his neck would be when she put the arrow through.
But still, that's one of the most iconic kills and like one of the first iconic slasher kills. And that's another thing where Friday the 13th was the starting point, was like making slashes about the gore, because Halloween had kills and Black Christmas had kills, but it didn't really have gore, not in the way this movie had it. This was all about, the gore.
A lot of blood, a lot of gore, and a lot of camp counselors saying, hey, what are you doing here? No, These POV shots that we got in all throughout this movie, you get a ton of POV.
Yeah.
But yeah, you all that silly shit aside, you know, of how she would have got under there and how she did it, that was never the point of Friday the 13th. Yeah, you were right. It was just all about the gore, and I feel like they gave Tom Savini free reign. Do whatever you want, man. How could you do this and make this really cool?
Yeah.
And you get all these great kills, and it's, you know, the birth of Jason Voorhees. That's it. We get... And this is one of the, I would say, you know, biggest shock endings when we see the boy come up and grab her on the canoe. you know, Halloween, we look over the edge with Loomis and Michael is gone. In Black Christmas, you hear Billy up in the attic doing this. But they played Friday the 13th. They really set you up in a way where I don't think you expected that to happen. The music is calm. The water is calm. You've got, you know, Alice is just putting her hand over the side, kind of playing with the water. Adrian King's doing this great job. Yeah. Being, it's a really calm, serene picture. And then out of nowhere, up over the canoe, you get you get Jason. We see that it was all in her head. And she's like, where's the boy? Where's the little boy from the water? Oh, no.
I need to rewatch this. I haven't watched it in a long time, but it's great.
I watch it way too much.
And what's also great about this is, you know, they didn't even have an idea. They just, Sean S. Cunningham just wrote a paper ad, says Friday the 13th, coming soon, and then hoped that anyone would call. And like he had the name, and that was it. And from that out, he made this movie just to make money. And I think Sean S. Cunningham was doing porn before this, and probably after
this. Yeah, I
think so.
He was like an editor, maybe? I don't know if he was directing porn, but I think he was doing something with it. I think you're right.
And so it's kind of a turning point for the slasher movies. This is where slasher movies become slasher movies, all about the money, the gore, and there's still great slasher movies coming afterwards, but this like was the formula and like what
the
slasher
movie
was.
They stuck to it and it worked. Yeah.
And I gotta say, if you think about a slasher movie, about slasher movies in general, you think about Friday the 13th. If there's any slasher parody, it's always set at a camp. Even though there are lots of different slasher, like there's slashes at prom night, there's slashes on Valentine's Day, but the one on the camp, that's the one people think about because this is the slasher.
Yeah. All right. So what do we got? What's up next for us?
Well, in the same year as Dressed to Kill, Cannibal Holocaust, and Friday the 13th, we also got a little movie by a director who didn't do anything else, really. No, we're talking about, for many people, maybe even the best horror movie. For some, even just the best movie in general. 1980s The Shining by Stanley Kubrick.
Yes.
With Jack Nicholson playing himself.
Shelley Duvall, Danny Lloyd, was
Scatman
it Danny
Carruthers.
Lloyd?
Yeah, I think
Oh, Scatman Carruthers is so good in it. The Shining. We have talked extensively about The Shining. It is a masterpiece of a horror movie. Even if I know people say all the time, well, that's not what King wanted, blah, 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 blah. I don't care. These are two different takes on this material, and Stanley Kubrick is in the same bracket as your Hitchcocks, your Kurosawas, as one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, if not, you know, pretty militant in his directing style.
He was completely crazy.
Yeah, people say quite a bit, like it was really tough to work with the guy. We would shoot the same thing 70 times before he got it exactly how he wanted it. But in his defense, he would do it until he got it right, and that often resulted in a masterpiece of a movie. And this one, for some reason, has been dissected to the point where people are like, oh, well, if he was riding his bike this way, it doesn't make sense that the hallway would go that way because it just can't do that. The structure of the building, it wouldn't match up. This, you know, there's whole documentaries about this fucking movie. It's just such a powerful... And for me, though, the one thing in this movie, as much as I love everything, I shouldn't say one thing, there's two things that always get me and just put the biggest smile on my face. The first one is the opening. That bum, 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 bum. And you have this helicopter shot just going over the water, and then you finally meet up with the car going up the mountainside. That shot is just, I think, one of the greatest shots in all of cinema. The music, it sets you up with this overbearing sense of dread. Somehow you know you're going somewhere where you shouldn't be going, and it just builds you to that point. And the second piece has always been Jack coming up the stairs at Wendy. Give me the bat, Wendy. Give me the bat. And she's swinging at him like, get away, get away. And he's like, I'm not going to hurt you, Wendy. I'm just going to bash your fucking brains in. I'm going to bash them right the fuck in, Wendy. Nicholson, one of his best performances of all time.
Yeah, it's kind of with Nicholson, it's really just like Nicholson, like going a bit over the top. Like he still didn't, like that's the problem that Stephen King fans and Stephen King have, is that like in the book, Jack Torrance is like an actual, he's a loving father and he is turned by the hospital. Jack Nicholson never looked like a loving father in this movie.
He did but he turns really quickly. You know, we kind of see him trying to, like, I'm not drinking, I'm not doing this. It was an accident, Wendy. She, you know, brings it up. Did you do this after Danny gets that first mark on him? I loved Nicholson's just descent into madness, though. When he's sitting on the edge of the bed, just staring out the window, and Danny comes in and they're talking like, I love you, Dan. I'd never hurt you, Dan. Watching his descent into crazy is just, it's such an amazing performance.
Yeah.
And the story's so good.
It really is. And I think we had this conversation before how this is one of the scariest movies for me, just because the whole feeling, everything feels wrong. And it feels like, it feels weird watching it just in the way, because it's so scary. I don't know. I think back then we even named the episode after what I said, that the director feels like it's directed by a ghost. It just feels like not a movie. And it is amazing. And I'm still, the scariest scene for me in this whole movie is when all of a sudden there's like a guy in a bear suit giving a blowjob to another guy.
Yeah, that is pretty fucked up. Because you have that really intense music at the same time.
Yeah. And I think Shelley Duvall is just like running away from someone up the stairs, and then she just sees them sitting there.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be an empty hotel. So
yeah, there's a lot of fucked up imagery in this movie. I mean, the old lady, that's scared me so bad as a kid, because in true Kubrick fashion, it just, you know, you get that long static shot of the bathtub. The hand slowly grabs the shower curtain and moves it out of the way. This figure slowly gets out and starts walking over to Jack, you know, this beautiful woman. And then you get the shot in the mirror and it's like, you get these really intense noises. It's it works on every level. It's, to your point, I see why there are individuals who say this is one of the greatest horror movies of all time. I get it.
Yeah.
I do understand.
And even one of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, so now for the end, for the last two, we have two werewolf movies, right? Back to back, shot at the same time. I think there's even like some overlap, I think. So let's start with the first one, An American Werewolf in London, 1981, directed by John Landis, right?
Yeah.
And I think he was also in talks of directing The Howling or something like that, or the other way around. Joe Dante was in talks of directing An American Werewolf in London. It's two werewolf movies coming out at the same time is kind of interesting, because we don't have as many werewolf movies.
But yeah, no, especially not on this list.
Yeah, but let's talk about the first one. Let's talk about An American Werewolf in London.
This is
great. It's fun.
one of my favorite werewolf movies. I absolutely love everything about Werewolf in London. Paris was okay. It was fine, but it's nothing compared to this original. And it's so interesting that, you know, John Landis at the time was coming off of Blues Brothers and Animal House. You know, they take this comedy director who's so great at comedy, and they're like, hey, you want to do this... you want to do this little werewolf movie, dude jumps on it. And as good of a story as it is, I think why this movie's on the list, and I want to say why it's so important, is the effects in this movie are just so good. Yeah. And not only the effects of the werewolf transformation, which I think is one of the probably most famous pieces of horror cinema, but his dead buddy walking around all the time, talking to him and shit. When he's having these nightmare visions of his friend, because what was the name of the Slaughtered Lamb? Was that the name of the bar? I always thought that was good, too.
It's this
that
movie
first
is,
little village.
It walks a very fine line of comedy and horror, like where it's both. It's funny and really scary at the same time.
But that makes sense for John Landis to be doing it. You know, it's almost like getting into a Sam Raimi movie. You know there's going to be comedy elements in there.
Yeah.
Sam Raimi, he can't help himself. And John Landis, I'm sure, coming off of Animal House, hanging around with all of those extremely funny human beings all of the time, and then doing Blues Brothers, you know, right before Werewolf in London, he did Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
One of the greatest comedy movies of all time. So this guy, it's probably just in his blood to put those comedy elements in there, and you see that stuff in London. But where it works so good is, I think, it's not werewolves in the woods somewhere, even though it starts off because they first get attacked when they're backpacking, and then they end up in London, but then you get the werewolf like on the streets of London, which I think is so cool, because we didn't really see a ton of that before.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly, and that whole thing, like it's the typical trope of like first the main character has to get attacked in the woods. Like this is a typical werewolf movie, actually. Like the main character gets attacked and then is kind of wondering, am I gonna turn into a werewolf? Am I gonna go crazy? What's going on? Learns about werewolves, and it's one of those movies where it's actually man against himself. Like he doesn't want to be a werewolf. This is what's great about werewolves in general, is that they're usually the beast inside that's coming out. I'm just reading Dance Macabre by Stephen King, and he even says that like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a werewolf movie. And
In a lot of ways it is.
Yeah, and I never thought about it that way, but it totally makes sense. And it's always like the beast inside, it's man against himself. And
Because even all the visions he keeps seeing are people telling him to kill himself. They're like, kill yourself before you fucking turn into a monster person. Like, you got to do it. You got to kill yourself.
Yeah, so, yeah, but this movie, it's really funny. And like his conversations with his dead friend that he has visions of, they're really funny, while the guy is standing there with a big wound in his chest.
All torn to shreds. And those effects, I'm telling you, the effects in this movie, oh, they're so good.
The effects.
And they still hold up so well.
Yeah.
That transformation sequence was truly something special at the time. What had anybody done before that where you had like a slimy, gross, face expanding, you know, huge nails, all this stuff coming out, sort of a transformation? It was just so new.
Yeah. And it's just such a good movie. And what I just realized while we were talking, and you said like what else John Landis did, and now just like looking through his filmography, because I always thought of John Landis as a horror director, because I guess we horror fans have kind of claimed him, and he did two episodes of The Masters of Horror. He only made one horror movie, really.
Well, he did a segment in the Twilight Zone movie, right?
Yeah, but like he did one full horror movie. He did the Michael Jackson Thriller video, and he made some segments every now and then, like you said, with the Twilight Zone movie, and like maybe, I don't know, like Dangerous, the short films, maybe Bloody Mary could be a horror movie. I don't know, but it's not one that people talk about.
Yeah, I've never seen that one.
But he's actually like a classic comedy director, you could say. But for some reason, we horror fans have claimed him to be like a horror guy, even though looking through his filmography, he's not really.
Well, that's because he did one of the best werewolf movies of all time, and the Thriller video.
Yeah, the Thriller video is... Yeah, it's got Vincent Price in it. It's one of the best things ever.
Oh, he did such a... His voiceover and all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
I still miss him.
I know. We always will. All right. So we've got, what, one left?
Yeah, we've got one left. And it's another werewolf movie. It's The Howling by Joe Dante.
Joe Dante. Yeah.
Who is also like... Joe Dante, he made a few more horror movies. He's much more of a horror guy than John Landis, but like mostly like horror comedies. Like he's known for Gremlins, I think. He also made the first Piranha movie.
And,
but then he went into comedy really quick. Like even Gremlins and is more comedy than horror, really.
I would say it's got a lot of comedy stuff. And then he did Gremlins 2. He did one of my favorite animated movies of all time, though, Small Soldiers.
Yeah,
I love Small Soldiers.
Well, kind of anime. Like, it's still real people.
It's like CGI, live action, soldiers. CGI blend. Yeah. But it's such a, that's a great movie. Like, even not as just a children's movie.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievably good.
I love that movie. I got it on DVD because I watched it as a kid and remembered that I loved it. And then I just got it on DVD and I still love it. It's one of those movies.
Yeah.
Usually the movies I loved as kids, I don't like anymore, or at least not as much. But Small Soldiers, I watched again as a grown up and still love it as much as I did as a kid.
But Alan, it's so good. But let's talk about The Howling a little bit, since that's the one we're here to talk about. As you had mentioned, this is another werewolf movie.
Yeah.
And this does not have the comedy elements, I feel, that you get with an American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, this is played straight.
Very straight, very horror. And it opens up. The opening of this movie always made me uncomfortable, and it still makes me uncomfortable. Her in that, we've got Dee Wallace. The movie opens with Dee Wallace. She's an investigative reporter or a news anchor of some sort.
Yeah.
And this serial killer that they've been trying to find for all this time has taken a liking to her. So they're trying to use her. She agrees to it. They're not just using her. She agrees to help set up this sting to try and catch this guy. And she ends up in this back room of a porn shop, you know, the little video room where you'd go put your money in or pay your money and watch some smut movies. She ends up back there with this killer, and we're watching this really, like, nasty rape on the screen. And I'm almost surprised they got away with that, because it's really, I mean, that sequence is uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have this man talking to her from the shadows, who's like, oh, yeah, watch this. Don't you like that? It's just, it's so gross and super, just, I don't know. It's nasty.
Yeah,
the whole thing
really
is nasty.
Is.
And she barely makes it out alive. She gets some PTSD, tries to get back on the air, but has sort of a breakdown in front of the camera. And they say, you know what? Why don't we get you off to this retreat for a while, send you off to help you get mentally better. We think this will be good for you. So she takes off to this retreat. Well, it turns out almost everybody at the retreat is werewolves.
Yeah.
And the guy that she killed, or the guy that was killed, Eddie, this serial killer character, we see his body has disappeared from the morgue. People who know her are trying to figure out what's going on. And that leads us eventually. I love the bookstore scene. When you always get that scene, like somebody who has a book for everything. Oh, you want a book about this? And that was the same guy from Gremlins.
Yeah.
Who ran the, what's his name? Now I can't remember. I would know it if I saw it on this list, but
yeah.
Anyway.
He,
and the rest of the movie, we now have a really fucking cool werewolf movie.
Yeah, and I just said that An American Werewolf in London has like the typical plot of like the main character is turned into a werewolf and then has to find out what's going on. How do I fight this? And this one is one of the few werewolf movies where that, well, it kind of happens at the end in sorts, but really the main actress is not fighting herself. She is fighting the actual werewolves. And
yeah,
that's, well, she is actually just like attracting them. She's not even really fighting anyone. Until the end when she's saved. Like, she really doesn't do much. She's mostly bait, really.
No, she only has really the one, was there like one big encounter for her? But yeah, you're right. Oh, most of it happens at the end. Everything's almost at the end. Oh, Dick Miller. Dick Miller is his name. Because I really liked him in Tales from the Crypt, too, in Demon Knight. I always enjoyed him.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, he was at the hotel with all of them.
Yeah.
So where The Howling, for me, always works so good is, again, and I think it's in all werewolf movies. What you have to do in a werewolf movie for me is make good-looking werewolves.
Yeah.
That's it. And not just, you know, a head goes by really quick, or you see a close-up on the swipe of an arm, where you know they clearly just made the arm piece to do that.
Yeah.
And that's why I've always loved Dog Soldiers. Neil Marshall just, he puts the werewolves front and center, and they do that in The Howling as well. You get the werewolves that are just right there. They're front and center. So much of the lore is the same. You know, you get bit by one, you get scratched by one, you turn into a werewolf at the full moon. If you get attacked by one, that's going to happen. But with this, you had some in-between transformations that I thought were good, where you just have the eyes, you know, the jawline kind of out a little bit, the teeth really big. And Dee Wallace is, you know, she's a horror icon.
Yeah, for sure.
And, so yeah, had you seen this for the first time?
Yeah, I watched this for the first time today.
Okay, so I want to hear your thoughts then.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like this was fun, and yeah, I was surprised because I expected the typical werewolf story, and like this is different. This is about her fighting these werewolves. I thought it was funny that like her husband is even like a vegetarian. Like he's yeah, after one night, he's gone for a bit, and then he comes back, and all of a sudden, yeah, meat tastes great, yeah. And
if you're hungry enough, it's good.
Yeah, and actually, what they changed here to the lore is that werewolves can turn at will.
Yes, that's true.
If they want to turn into a werewolf, they can. What's his name again? I like that this is the first big movie role of Robert Picardo, who's... who's the doctor in the Star Trek Voyager. That's where I know him from most of the time. And he plays Eddie Quist. And I read some trivia that he was kind of mad because he is this trained actor. He was on stage for forever. And then his first movie was a cheap horror movie where he is in makeup all of the time. Like, don't even right. see his face, really. And...
Yeah, yeah, because after you finally see his human face, she had already thrown the acid on him.
Yeah, he's already hurt. Yeah,
yeah.
And I like so much about it. Like the opening, like you said, is great. And I didn't know what was fully going on. By the way, in the opening, she's standing in a phone booth, and then leaving that phone booth, and the guy behind outside the phone booth is Roger Corman. The
Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because
I didn't notice.
He gave Joe Dante his start in horror, and so he got him in there as a cameo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and even though, yeah, like I said, this is not a comedy, it has some funny moments, especially with Dick Miller's character with the clerk. Yeah, he also just has the silver bullets because he had
them
made for...
Well, he said, yeah, he had ordered them for someone, but they never came and picked them up.
Which is, what happened to that guy?
Right, yeah. Where'd the guy who needed silver bullets, where did he go? Right.
And the movie is really good, and especially much better than I expected. And I would say
it's a real solid werewolf flick. And, you know, I think this, whereas London, you know, had all the comedy elements in there, I think this kind of elevated the werewolf movie to, like, you can make a really good werewolf movie and make it serious, keep it straight. Because even, you know, your older stuff, the Lon Chaney stuff, still had a lot of funny moments in it and things like that. Whereas you didn't get kind of a straight werewolf movie. But this one we did. And this would lead us to shit like, you know, Silver Bullet. And one of my modern favorites, the Late Phases, we talked about it last week, is just an amazing. And again, Dog Soldiers. Fuck, if you haven't seen Dog Soldiers.
Yeah,
so
Dog
good.
Soldiers is good. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess we're through number
so that's it.
61 to 70. So let's see. So... On the one hand, I called up, let me see, we're on episode, no, it doesn't say, where does it say? And usually it says right here. We're on episode 90-something for sure. We got a few episodes left. We're on episode 94, so it's 6 more episodes.
Okay.
And we got 3 more episodes.
3 more of these.
About 101 horror movies you have to see before we die.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to do it. We're going to make it through this list.
Yeah.
And looking through, there's a ton of good stuff still coming.
Yeah. Next week, I have to watch 2 movies that I haven't seen.
I have to watch 2 as well. So we'll see if maybe they're the same 2.
But for today,
we're going to wrap this thing up. If you want to get into contact with us on all the social media platforms, it's at IHOH Podcast. And if you want to email us, you can email us ihohpodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to jump onto Apple Podcasts and leave a rate and review, that would be greatly appreciated. Even though we're wrapping this thing up, it's still nice to hear what people think of the show.
Yeah, especially
so if you have
now,
a couple
like,
minutes.
I want a goodbye or something.
Yeah, somebody give us a good goodbye review. We'd appreciate that.
Finally,
so for the international,
5 stars.
Yes. Good riddance. For the International House of Horrors podcast, I've been Joe Merle.
And I've been Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.